Awesome. It was a great night last night, and it was such an honor to be there and to be a part of a church here that rallies around this community, not only families in your church, but this church is serving families all around the community, which is incredible but to be a part of. My name's Jason. It's such a privilege to be with you here this morning. I come to you from Houston. I get to travel around the country, and normally I get on a plane in Houston, and wherever I land, it feels better where I land. This is the only place where it doesn't feel better. It actually felt worse. But I do feel a little bit at home and sweating a lot here. Next week I'm in Iowa. I'm a little concerned because I think it's going to be cold, and we don't know how to do cold, do we? But it's good to be here. The best way for me to introduce myself to you is to actually show you a picture of the world that I come from. This is the very female, very estrogen-filled world that I live in. And so let me explain very quickly. That's my wife there, Emily, in the back. We've been married 20 years this past June. We met on the campus of Texas A&M University. There's always at least one of you whooping crazy ones. If you're one of the crazy ones, come find me after. That is our set of girls. So there in the royal blue is Darby. There next to her in the gray tank top is Presley. Second from the left is Macy. They were 6'4" and 2" when we became foster parents and welcomed Marley there in the glasses at the front into our home. She was our very first placement. She was 3 days old in the city of Houston. We say it this way, that we have had the fortunate but unfortunate privilege of adopting her into our family. Fortunate in the sense that we love that she's our daughter and that we get to call her our daughter and that we get to be her mommy and daddy. Unfortunate in the sense that we wish that none of this was ever even a part of her story. We wish that she was able to go back home. We wish that mom was healthy. We wish that all of that could have happened. And so we have lived in this tension for the last 10 years. And then about 5 years into our journey, my wife became aware of some situations. And I don't know how your marriage works, but when my wife becomes aware of a situation, that's the equivalent of us having prayed about it and talked about it for a long, long, long time. Really, the decision's made, and then my job is to figure out how we're gonna make it happen. And that can be anything from, I've got a DIY home project idea for you, and it's done in her head. My job is to figure out how to make it happen. Or it can be as extreme as, I've become aware of a 17-year-old and a little baby boy, and they don't have a place to live, and I think they need to move in with us. All but done in her head, my job is to figure out how to make that happen. And so Gianna there on the far left, when she was 17, she moved into our home. She had grown up in foster care since she was 6 years old. And now she had little baby Jordan in her orbit and in her world. They spent the first week of his life sleeping on a caseworker's floor in Dallas because they had a hard time finding a home for a teenager with a long rap sheet and a little baby. Because that's just the reality of the world of foster care. The older these kids get, the harder they are to place, the more likely they are to age out to practically nothing. And so my wife became aware of this, and they moved in when Gianna was about 17 and a half. Jordan was a couple of weeks old, and they've been a part of our family for the last 5 years. This picture is our most recent outdated family picture. You'll see another little baby there in the middle, and it's so outdated that there's actually now a third baby in the mix of our family. And so we love Gianna, and we love babies. We don't love Gianna having babies, and we talk to her about that often. The reality is this, is that Gianna is not without her struggles. And the reality, frankly, for all of us is that we are not without our struggles. And what's true for all of us is that as we struggle and as we stumble through life, what we need most are people around us to help support us and be there for us. And so our commitment to Gianna from day one has been this: look, no matter what, you're stuck with us forever. You're stuck with us forever. And 5 years in, and she doesn't fully yet believe that, because no one in her life has ever given her reason to believe that. And so our hope and our prayer one day is that she wakes up one day soon and she just rests in the fact that there are people who are stuck with her forever, and that she lean into that. And so that's a little bit of our journey. I'll share some of her story and our story together as we continue this morning. But I love stories, and I love good stories, and I especially love good stories in the middle of a media news cycle that is mostly filled with bad stories. I frankly don't pay very much attention to the news anymore, because it just is kind of like drinking from the poisonous fire hydrant at times, right? you just start to feel like my soul is just weighed down with all this. But every once in a while, a bright spot story kind of cuts through all the noise. And my favorite stories are the ones of kind of the Good Samaritan stories. People come up upon something and they do something heroic. It could be as crazy as an 18-wheeler flips over. It's crushing a car and some guys get out of their trucks, probably Florida guys, big Texas or Florida, big guys, big trucks. And a few of them get around the 18-wheeler and like in the superhuman, supernatural strength, lift it up just enough for the person to crawl out to safety. Like those are the stories. And those are the stories that kind of draw us in and compel us and cut through the noise of the bad stories. I recently came across a story like this, and it's one of these stories that causes you to pause and consider, what would I do in a situation like that? What would I do in a situation like that? And so watch this story that I came across out of Southern California. A guy comes across a burning car in a parking lot, and he responds a certain way, and his friend responds in a very different way. And we're left to consider, gosh, what would I do in a situation like that? Watch this. Maybe you guys can help me out back there.
Before this car went up in flames,
can we get it
the
up
driver
there?
Was pulled out by a Good Samaritan on his way to lunch at the Bollinger Road Shopping Plaza. Ram Harutsunyan says there were dozens of bystanders, but no one stepped up. He's in the white shirt, and you can see him run up to the driver and pull and drag him to safety before paramedics and firefighters arrive. His friend Leo shot this video of the rescue and put it on YouTube.
I was pretty surreal once we started.
I love that story. Aram comes across a burning car. He recognizes there's a guy in the car, and his response is to run towards the car and pull the guy out. And then maybe my favorite part of that story is at the very end, the reporter says, and his friend Leo stood nearby and recorded it on his phone and posted it on YouTube. And I'm like, yeah, I'm totally fine with being Leo in that situation, right? As a matter of fact, we live in a world that is becoming increasingly full of Leos, don't we? We all carry around cameras in our pockets, and we're really good at getting just close enough to get a good shot, but staying just far enough away to not get burned by anything. And we watch stories like this, and we're compelled to consider, what would I do in a situation like this? Would I run towards the burning car, or would I stay just far enough away to not get burned, but close enough to get a good shot and post it on YouTube? What's my response in a situation like this? You know, we largely live in a culture that has a particular narrative that all of us on some level experience and feel and are keenly aware of. Tim Keller, a pastor and an author, says it this way. He says that in order for us to really understand the implications and the gravity of the narrative of the gospel, we first have to understand the implications and the narrative and the gravity of the cultural narrative around us. And as we increasingly understand the cultural narrative in which we live, and then increasingly understand the gospel narrative in which we believe, we will begin to see where those two things come in conflict with one another. And then at some point in the midst of that conflict, we have to decide something's got to give. Something's got to give. These two things cannot coexist equally. We largely live in a culture that is driven by a narrative that suggests this. The goal of our life is to be comfortable and convenient and safe. And so when you come upon the burning car, stay away, isolate and insulate. You can even go so far as to say it this way. You could say that the goal of our life, according to the culture around us, is this. Go to school, make good grades so you can get into a good college, you can get a good degree that gets you a good salary, marry a good guy or girl, live in a good neighborhood, have a really good house, have a few good kids, drive some good cars, take some good vacations so that you can have a good Instagram profile and then have a really good retirement. And then hopefully you die in your sleep or how you somehow peacefully go and it's just good and calm. And then your kids kind of hopefully kind of repeat that cycle, rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. And the goal is to be good and comfortable and safe and to avoid and isolate from anything that is potentially difficult or that might disrupt that. That is largely the cultural narrative around us. And then we come across stories like this and we go, gosh, I want to be the kind of person who would run towards the burning car, but I'm just not sure because I live under the weight of this cultural narrative. And so what we're going to do this morning is we're going to see where the gospel narrative begins to counteract and conflict with that cultural narrative, and then we're going to ask ourselves some questions. Because what we begin to see as the gospel increasingly presses itself down into us, it begins to change and shift a lot of the questions that we ask as we increasingly become aware of the implications of the gospel through us. And so we're going to spend most of our time this morning in Galatians chapter 4, verse 4 through 5. Galatians chapter 4, verse 4 through verse 4 through 7, actually. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to read this, and then we're just going to go back through it verse by verse and pick it apart and draw out some implications and ask ourselves some questions. And then in the end, we're going to invite you to consider what your unique particular response might be. And so let me read through this. Galatians chapter 4, verse 4 through 7. When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the spirit of his son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you're no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. That's a lot. So if you were to come up to me and say, Jason, imagine this, you are stranded on a desert island. I would say, just great, that sounds great. Stop right there. When do we leave, right? You say, no. Matt, play this out. You're in a shipwreck and you're stranded on a desert island and everything's been destroyed, even most of your Bible, but you're left with just a few verses in the Bible. What verses would you choose? And I'd make a pretty strong argument for Galatians 4, verse 4 through 7. It tells us so much about who God is and what God does, the implications of his work on our behalf, and then ultimately the implications of how we then live that out and demonstrate it. And so let's start in Galatians 4, verse 4. This is actually my favorite Christmas verse. And can you believe that Christmas is next month? Isn't that wild to even say, right? And you guys get it. We're in South Texas. You're in Florida. Like, we're just days away from going outside and putting up Christmas lights and decorating the outside of our house and just sweating the whole time and just got this very visceral reaction and this very real sense of the world is not how it's supposed to be. I think that in heaven one day, when we go out and put Christmas lights on whatever house we have there, the weather's just going to be perfect, right? So hope is on its way, right? But we're all going to start doing that soon, and this is what we're celebrating at Christmas. Next month is crazy. When the fullness of time had come, that phrase literally means at just the right time. And so you could read it this way. At just the right time, God sent forth his son, born of a woman. We know her name to be Mary. And so there, right there is Christmas. At just the right time, Jesus was born through Mary. Now, verse 4 has an additional statement. It says, born under the law. The connotation there is that is this idea of born under a weight, under the weight of condemnation. So we don't talk a lot about that at Christmas. As a matter of fact, we don't talk at all about that at Christmas, really, because that's not very happy Christmas manger magi talk, right? We save that for Good Friday at Easter, but of course it's true at Christmas. Jesus himself in his ministry said, I've come into this world to die. I have come into this world to give my life as a ransom, to lay my life down. Ultimately, he says, I have been born into this world to be crushed by this world. That's what we celebrate at Christmas. If you were in a seminary class, the professor might say, this is what we call the doctrine of incarnation. The doctrine of incarnation. So here's what I like to take big complex things and make it just as simple as possible for me to understand. And so here's how I understand the doctrine of incarnation. And I suspect that every time I use this illustration, my very distinguished seminary professors are just rolling over in their graves, wishing I would stop saying this. But I don't, because it just makes sense to me, and I think it'll be helpful for you. I'm about to give you a gift. You ready for this? So I'm pretty sure in Florida, you have the same thing that we do in Texas, these restaurants that we call Tex-Mex restaurants, which is basically fake Mexican food, right? Palatable, Americanized Mexican food. And then Texas has said, we can do whatever we want, so we're just going to make it our own and call it Tex-Mex food. Sometimes I'll be in Seattle or up in the Northeast, and they'll say, hey, we want you to feel at home while you're with us. We're going to take you out for Mexican food. And I think, I don't know if Seattle Mexican is the same as like Tex-Mex, right? I'm a little concerned, right? And so most of the time, actually, I'll just be frank, my wife and I aren't very adventurous people. We're actually quite boring. We eat the same things. We go to the same restaurants. We sit at the same booths. We order the same things when we go. But every once in a while, we'll like get this this spark in us. We're like, let's try something new. And then we kind of laugh at each other. Ha, like that's actually going to happen. But we'll spend like 15 minutes talking about what it would be like if we actually tried something new, right? And then 15 minutes later, we just go with what we know. And so not long ago, we were actually driving across town go eat. And the whole way on our way over there, we were thinking, hey, there's this new restaurant. There's this new place we can try. And then I think we kind of blacked out for a minute. And when we woke up, the car had pulled itself into our favorite taco place. And we're like, I guess this is just where we're going. And we ordered the same thing. And what we order is the same all the time. And it includes queso. Which queso is interesting because if someone came to you and said, here's a big block of cheese, do you want to eat all of this at one time? We'd say, ah, that feels gross and unhealthy. But if you melt it and you put a bunch of baskets of chips with it, totally in, right? And so we order queso every time. The only adventurous thing that we do is sometimes we order queso and sometimes we order queso con carne. Yeah. Con carne means with meat or with beef, and it's the same root word that we get the word incarne from. So when we talk about the incarnation of God, the birth of Jesus, really what we're talking about is God with beef on, is God with meat on. You can understand why my seminary professors don't like what I'm doing right now, right? But as if eating queso wasn't a spiritual enough experience already, now I'm giving you the gift of going and eating queso con carne and it just being that much more of a spiritual experience, right? And now you can impress your friends. You can order it, and as you're eating it, you can say, you know what this reminds me of? And they'll just be so impressed with you, and then they'll kind of talk bad about you on the way home in the car, right? Like, who's that guy, right? This is what we mean. It's God with meat on. It's God with beef on. And so we see this idea playing out now in the incarnation, that God is the kind of God who says, I see you where you are, and I'm coming after you. I'm coming after you. This is what we celebrate at Christmas. This idea that God says, I see your brokenness, and I see the struggle, and I see the difficulty, and rather than him saying, man, it is a mess, so you guys need to get your act together, and one day maybe you can work your way to where I am. Instead, God says, I see you where you are, and I'm entering into where you are. That Jesus would enter into our brokenness, literally wrap himself up in our brokenness, be carried by our brokenness to the cross, be broken by our brokenness so that we don't have to be broken anymore. That is the essence of the gospel. You know, God has every right and all the power and authority to stay up in heaven and snap his fingers and call it all fixed. But for some reason, he chooses a different way. And his way is when he sees brokenness, he's compelled to move towards it and become a part of it. This is the MO of God. That God is the kind of God that moves towards and not away. Matthew chapter 1 says it this way. Here's our Christmas verse, that his name will be Emmanuel, which means that God is with us. He's right here in the flesh with meat on. That God has entered into our story. And then John chapter 1, verse 14 says, the word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. That phrase, made his dwelling, literally means tabernacled among us. In other words, you could read it like this, that the word, Jesus, became flesh, wrapped himself up in our brokenness, and he built a home in it. He stayed. In other words, it's as if Jesus is saying, look, I'm entering into your story, and you're stuck with me forever. And maybe one day you'll fully rest in that truth. Henry Nouwen says it this way. He says, compassion is not a bending towards the underprivileged from a privileged position. It's not a reaching out from on high to those who are less fortunate below. It's not a gesture of sympathy or pity for those who fail to make it in the upward pull. On the contrary, compassion means going directly to those people and places. Listen to this. What a statement. It means going directly to those people and places where suffering is most acute and building a home there. The cultural narrative around us says when you come across those places where suffering is most acute, isolate, insulate, and avoid. And the narrative of the gospel begins to flip that script and says when we come across places where suffering is most acute, we don't do so accidentally, we actually intentionally seek out those places where suffering is most acute, and we stay there. It becomes an entirely new reference point for our lives. You ever built a home or moved to a new neighborhood or a new city? It takes a while to kind of establish equilibrium and a reference point for where the streets are and where the grocery store is and just how you're going to navigate around. In essence, there's a sense in which as the gospel implications of it become more deeply embedded into who we are, it begins to shift the reference points by which we live. It begins to change the things that we center our lives around. That we become the kind of people that move towards and not away. Why? Because God sees hard places and broken people and moves towards them and not away from them. And so I think all of us on some level, here's what we want. And we struggle with this because the cultural narrative is heavy and it's loud. But I think on some level, all of us want to not only increasingly raise our hands in worship to a God who has moved towards us in our brokenness, but simultaneously, we also want to become the kind of people who refuse to use those same hands to push the brokenness of others away. We're tired of living in that disconnect, in that discord. We increasingly want to raise our hands in worship to a God that has moved towards us and simultaneously use those same hands to move towards the brokenness of others. That's what we want. That's what we want. We're tired of being the Leos, and we want to be the Arams in those stories. And so God has moved towards us. It's what he does. It's his method of operation. The whole story arc of Scripture is God moving towards broken people. It's just what he does. And then Paul begins to unpack in verse 4, 5, and 6, or 5, 6, and 7, the implications on our lives. And so the first thing that is impacted when Jesus steps into our story and begins to write an entirely new story, Paul begins to unpack the implications on our past. And so in verse 5, he says, to redeem those who were under the law, remember that phrase, under the law, under the weight of this crushing condemnation. Jesus was born under the weight of condemnation, verse 5, to redeem those who were under that same weight of condemnation so that we might be adopted as sons. We might receive adoption. We might be introduced into an entirely new reality, new family, new provision, new protection from God. So in verse 5, the first implication that we see of the gospel as it begins to change our story is this, is that our past is redeemed. That's past tense language. We were once under the weight of condemnation, and then Jesus took our place there and redeemed us out from underneath it. Our past has been redeemed. In Romans chapter 8, it says, there is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus, because the law of the Spirit of life has set us free from the law of sin and death. There is therefore now no condemnation. You know, we're taught on some level that our past is a source of shame. It's a source of embarrassment. The things that maybe we've done, or perhaps even the things that have been done to us. And on some level, we wish that the gospel was Jesus stepping into our story and erasing all memory of the past as if it never happened. I remember growing up in Sunday school, maybe VBS, and you know, sometimes we try to be real cute in the Christian world and our cuteness, like at the sacrifice of actually what's right theology sometimes, right? And so I vividly remember being taught in maybe a VBS setting that the word justified, what it means is it's just as if, kind of play on words with justify, just as if it never happened. And I understand the sentiment, but then you walk away going, but it did happen. Like it's still there. The memory is still there. The grief is still there. The trauma is still there. The feeling is still there. Why doesn't Jesus just erase all of that? Because I think he actually has a better way for us. You know, our past are no longer sources of condemnation and shame and embarrassment. They now, in the gospel, have the capacity to become platforms of celebration. No longer sources of condemnation, now platforms of celebration. Why? Because we can say, look at what Jesus has done. I was once dead and now I'm alive. I was once blind and now I can see. I was once lame and now I can walk. I was once riddled by addiction or shame or guilt or embarrassment or fear, but Jesus. It's a platform of celebration. The gospel has the capacity to change the relationship that we have with our own past. Not erase our past, but change the relationship that we have with it. So not long after Gianna moved into our home, it was one of those days where like the goal of the day is, are all of our kids home? And did everyone at least eat something today? Even if it's like a Pop-Tart and a Sprite, right? Did everyone eat something and are we all home? Great. Mommy and Daddy are going to our room. don't bother us. We're just going to veg out on probably some Chip and JoJo at the time or something like that, right? One of those days, we all understand. And then we hear a faint knock on our bedroom door late one night, and it is followed by a three-word question that nothing simple.